there, and thanks for listening. If you're enjoying our podcast and have a recommendation about someone you think we should have on to share their voice and journey with the world, by all means, let us know. It could be an aid worker, monastic, author, journalist, doctor, resistance leader, really anyone with some tie or another to the ongoing situation in Myanmar or anything related to its history or culture. To offer up a name, go to our website, insightmyanmar.org, and let us know. But for now, just sit back and take a listen to today's episode.
Wen, research fellow from Knowledge Circle Foundation, and on the other hand, I am also studying in Chiang Mai University, majoring in economics. I am a PhD candidate right now, and I focus on migration, especially between Myanmar and Thailand, and also political economy of Myanmar.
Great. Thank you so much for joining us on this episode of Insight Myanmar Podcast. And these two areas that you brought up, they are critical areas right now, the political economy of Myanmar and migration between Burma and Thailand. So let's start by looking at the issues of the political economy, as you mentioned, and bringing your economic background and training to what we're seeing there. We've had Sean Turnell on before. He's broken down the economy in quite some detail, and it's good to have another check-in. So from what angle have you been analyzing and reviewing the economic conditions of Myanmar?
So currently what I focus on Myanmar political economy is, conflict economy, especially after 2021, how the situation has changed. And, after 2021, how the actors has, changed and which area that, impact on the Myanmar economy.
So give us, for those listeners that are coming in with very little background or understanding of the economy, give us like a broad overview of what has happened to the economy and how dramatic and drastic the changes have been pre-21 to post-21. And then we'll get into some of the greater details after that general broad overview.
Okay, Myanmar economy mainly focus on the resource-based economy, and its its main extractive industry and also agricultural sector and a little bit of service industry. And in Myanmar, we also have formal economy and informal economy, which is great part of Myanmar economy. And formal economy is controlled by the State Administration Council, in short, we call SAC, and in informal sector is, all the other stakeholders and non-state actors engaging in that area. So Myanmar economy is underdeveloped for a long time, and it has a weak infrastructure and some, fault lines that we name as a fault line. Transportation sector and very underdeveloped, and other infrastructure like road, telecommunication. So migration is in my heart because I came from the normal family, and my brother migrated and helped our family, and I got lucky by having, you know, brother who migrated and assist for my education. And when I, you know, I am only one in my family that, you know, can do my father's study, and I got a chance to explore more about why we cannot, you know, break the cycle of the trap in the migration cycle, right? Mm. So I want to help others, and I want to also help our migrant workers who are the unsung hero for the, you know, country situation like Myanmar. So before I came to Thailand for my PhD, I worked inside Myanmar and study about the migrant workers and how especially for the migrant returnees, their experience while they are in abroad, and what are their difficulties, and what are their expectations, and how the recipient family inside Myanmar utilize, you know, remittances inside Myanmar, whether they use in productive sector or whether they use in, you know, other non-productive sector, I will say. So that's very interesting study for me. And from that study, I got a chance to explore more about the rural family and how migrant workers support back home in agricultural sector in rural area. And also their spending behavior too. That's the, I mostly focus recipient family and migrant returnees inside Myanmar. But when I got a chance to stay in Thailand and study for my graduate study, I got a chance to meet with the, you know, migrant workers, their challenges in Thailand, especially after the pandemic and also political stability. And from that, you know, study, I got a chance to explore the wage gap between men and women who are working inside Myanmar, in Thailand. Most of them are formally registered in Thailand, and most of them engaging in the manufacturing sector. Even they are working at the same type of work, not only the basic pay, the additional pay are women get, you know, lower than men, even for the additional pay. But when we add the additional pay and analyze again, the wage gap is, you know, narrow. But the interesting thing is, even the women get pay lower than men, they send more remittances back home. So that's interesting pattern, and now I am trying to explore whether that really can reflect, you know, the whole sector and the reason behind from that, whether that's the altruism or family dynamics, or is it because of the, you know, kind of like, because women are, is it because I am trying to explore the reason behind. And last year, I got a chance to talk with, you know, some women group as a qualitative study. And the reason why they want to save more and send money back home is when they, you know, finish their contract or when they go back home, it's very difficult to find, you know, job which they get skilled here in abroad. So for them to save as much as they can and sending money back home is very important for their future, right? That's the saving that they can use when they get back home, because compared to other men, it's easy for them to join at the workforce inside Myanmar, whether at the rural area or whether, you know, they go to urban area.
This is such an interesting topic that you're covering, and I think this is also just underlying yet another example of the tremendous role that women are playing everywhere in this revolution. And just to underscore one of the important parts that you said there, that women are routinely, women migrants in Thailand are routinely getting less money than their male counterparts, and yet they are sending more money back through remittances back into Myanmar than their male counterparts, so that they're supporting their families and their communities that are really suffering under the last several years post-coup, and being able to provide them with more of their earnings. So that's, you know, it's just another one of those rather unseen, perhaps invisible ways that women are really a cornerstone and providing so much substance to keeping things going under these tremendously difficult times. And getting kind of deeper into that, those gender gaps, both gender gaps in terms of making less funds, but then sending more back and sending more out. Were you able to glean any understanding or information or analysis as to why women were sending more money than the men, even though they had less to work with of being able to send?
So last year, I, you know, got a chance to explore, and that's, you know, also came in my mind, mm-hmm. what motivate them,
yeah.
and what how they can save up and send more than their male counterpart, you know. So some women, and they try to find extra kind of like income by, you know, selling some food or clothing in their network, right? So in this way, they can really earn extra money to send many back home, and some kind of like teach each other about their skill that they came here or when they came from Myanmar. And also because of the, you know, digital knowledge, it's also start, you know, getting easy for them to share about their experience and, you know, also expand their network from that.
Mm-hmm.
So that is the one of the top reason some women who I interview got extra money.
Mm-hmm.
And some are like, you know, they share their room together and they live as a, you know, community network together here in Thailand. So they also can save up their expenditure, right? So there are several ways, but that's the two, you know, top reason that why they can save up more money and, you know, send money back home.
And were you able to understand any reason as to why, for the most part, women are choosing to send more money back home than their male counterparts?
You know, for women, when most of the women that I, you know, encountered during my study,
mm-hmm.
even they are, whether they are single or, you know, with a family, they want to go back home. And upon arrival to, when they get back home, they want to set up their own business.
Mm-hmm.
That's the one reason that they want to save more money and send money back home. And they also have, you know, married women, especially when they have children, they want to prioritize education for their children. So that's also another reason. And the common reason for, you know, most women who I interview, I figured out that, you know, when they get back home, it's difficult for them to join to the workforce. So it's, you know, send money back home and saving inside Myanmar is for their, you know, plan to move forward because they are not sure that they can join to the workforce, even they have experience here.
So you say that one of the reasons why they might send more is either because they want to start a business when they're back home or because they want to support their children. And yet Burmese male migrants also might want to start a business at home. They also have children. And so so there could be similarities within the genders. And so why is it, did you come to any conclusions or any guesses as to why women seem to be prioritizing the possibility of setting up a business or wanting to support their children? Why they seem to be giving more money in remittances back home than their male peers were doing?
So the main reason is, you know, like as I mentioned, it's for women, it's difficult to join the workforce when they get back home in Myanmar. So it's, you know, one way of security for them to save money as much as possible.
So they're more motivated to want to make the groundwork of establishing a business because they don't have the other opportunities that the men have. So that explains that part. As for children, is it, being a lay observer to this kind of research that you're doing, is it enough to just chalk it up to maternal instinct, that there's just a greater maternal instinct than paternal instinct and wanting to support the children? Is that basically what it comes down to, or is there more there?
That's a difficult one. I think I cannot really differentiate between that. But we, you know, kind of like explore, you know, during the survey, what do they prioritize in expenditure? And I think all gender, you know, explain that if they have children, you know, education is their priority. And I think I can't really differentiate about that.
But the numbers bear out that women support it more. Is that right?
Yeah. Yeah, it's true. It's true.
Right, right.
We also explore, you know, the financial burden of the migrant workers who are living here. And we explore some what are their difficulties. And the biggest challenges for them is documentation, right? The formal documentation process is not costly, but because of the, you know, the bureaucratic procedures and lengthy process, and also the, you know, because of the all the documentation, most of the migrant workers, they go through with the some agent, right? So it costs some people, it's cost up to 20,000 baht. So they are basically is like, you know, if they come with the MOU and engage in formal sector, they are basically is 8,000. If they have you know, overtime and other additional pay, maybe 16,000, 17,000. And for the documentation, it's cost up 20,000. So it's kind of like, you know, big burden for them. And that's the reason some got, you know, fall into the debt. And there is also no, you know, support for them, most of the migrant workers. So no support for them. I mean, there is no loan service for migrant workers. So during our, you know, study, we found some migrant workers who has some sort of, you know, loan that they, you know, got here. And the main reason for that loan come from the documentation process. So the formal documentation expenditure, it's not expensive, but it's very lengthy. And it has a, you know, also have a language barriers and everything. Most migrant workers, they need some sort of assistance, whether from employers or some agent to get it done, right? So if you go through with agent, it can cost up to 20,000 baht. So they are basically is like starting from 8,000, and if they got additional pay, it's 16,000, right? From their expenses, and also they also have obligation to send money back home every month, especially, you know, when family back in home are having, crisis. That cost is kind of like, you know, a big burden for them. And that's the one of the main reasons that, you know, they are in debt. And there is no support mechanism for migrant workers to get, you know, loan assistance or financial service in general, or, you know, for the documentation process. So as a consequence, some, you know, take a risk and live without formal documentation, but, you know, some get, you know, assistance from their employers. So but having, you know, legal documentation, it's for, you know, our own protection, right? With that documentation, you also can get the health services and other, you know, protection, right? So, and it's also for the employers. If workers has a documentation, they prefer to stay at that, you know, workplace for a long time. So it's, you know, benefit for both workers and employers. So from that, I also found out that, you know, employers also need to pay attention for their workers, you know, benefits. And it's not only for them, it's also for, you know, businesses.
Right, I see. Now, one of the interesting parts of this remittance process is that it brings together these two diverse areas that you're working on, the political economy of Myanmar and migration issues, because, as you say, it makes up the informal economy of Myanmar. And so the money that the Burmese migrant workers are making in Thailand, which then goes back through via remittances back into Myanmar, is then what's making up a large part of this informal economy outside of SAC control and the extractive resources. And so can you give us the broad strokes of what we're looking at in terms of both what percentage and what kinds of funds approximately the remittances make up, and then really the importance and the and the role that this growing sector of informal economy is playing in post-coup Myanmar and the resistance effort that continues to be underway?
So I think in the past, I think 2018, there was an estimation that personal remittances in Myanmar, formal estimation is like 4% of Myanmar GDP. But, you know, if you can kind of like, you know, informally, it can go up to like 8 to 11% of Myanmar GDP. So it's kind of like quite a lot. Like in other countries, remittances, you know, channel mostly migrant workers use informal channel to transfer money back home. So we can't really, estimate the exact figure yet. But after 2021, we obviously see that there are a lot of, people migrated from Myanmar, not only for the, you know, economic incentive, but also for education and because of the conflict in their, you know, area. So the remittances is kind of like, you know, very important for Myanmar economy. And on the other hand, it's by using informal channel, because of the current, you know, financial industry, infrastructure and situation for migrant workers. When we say they use informal channel, right? But it's not entirely informal. The study group that I explore, they use formal banking at this Thailand site, and the agent also use formal channel inside Myanmar to transfer to their, you know, recipe and household.
Mm-hmm.
So at the first mile, they also use formal channel. At the last mile, they also receive the formal channel, which means, you know, through bank, through the mobile money agency. So they use the formal channel, but seems like money never crossed the country, right? So that's also because of the current, you know, financial crime and all the, you know, scam industry. That's also the another area that we need to look at carefully, and how we can kind of like, you know, support our migrant workers to use formal channel, and how we can kind of like, you know, support our migrant workers to use formal channel and send money back home safely.
So then that brings up two related questions that have become of great concern lately. One is that there have been measures taken in Thai and Singaporean banks to limit any money transfers going into Myanmar for fear of the relation to the scam industries. So you have on one side of the border limitations there. On the other side of the border, this is nothing new. The SAC has done whatever it's been able to do to freeze accounts, stop funds, to be able to actually take them and remove the funds, take them themselves. That there have been really, the SAC has done whatever it's been able to do on their side to be able to stop any funds from going away from its control. And so on both sides of the border, there is very much a concerted effort to make this even more difficult than it already is. And so what have you seen in your years of following this, that the ways that they've been able to innovate around this, and how worried are you, how worried are they about how much stricter it's starting to become now as we speak?
So that's also, you know, one of my concerns too. Mm. And so I try to explore more on that matters. And this is not kind of like, you know, we cannot really solve that this in one day. And we cannot just change the regulation or process, because it's need, you know, a lot of advocacy process and, you know, practices and everything, right? So what I mean is the mechanism need to set up in both sides, not only from, you know, border side, mm-hmm. and also inside the country, mm-hmm. right? Mm-hmm. And it's, I think it's also obvious for when migrant workers send money back home, it's not one time. It's not, you know, kind of like a huge amount of money that they are sending. Mm-hmm. We already, you know, it's very obvious, and we already get the kind of like, you know, evidence that they send money back home monthly, mm-hmm. and small amount, mm-hmm. that they earn, mm-hmm. from their work, right? So that's the kind of like, you know, mechanism from both sides need to set up, and how they can give security and also, you know, kind of like flexible way for migrant workers to send money back home, right? That's the also, that's also linked with the legal documentation process, right? Because they need a document to open bank account. That know your customer process is very important. It's not to be politicized. It's, we need to be very practical to solve that issue. We need to think for the migrant workers, we also need to think about the financial infrastructure that we need to set up and, you know, and also financial inclusion, capacity and knowledge for the, for our future.
Mm-hmm. Right. And so given that this is a real lifeline for so many Myanmar communities now, how dire is the risk that these challenges of getting the funds where they need to go is becoming so much increasingly more difficult to do, again, because of the fear of scam centers on one side of the border and because of the SAC control on the other?
So last 3 days ago, I listened to the one, I think, a podcast from YouTube, and the title is "Why Indians Are Rule Breakers," and it's explain about the very strict laws and regulation and measure in India, and that there is no small room for to do business or whatever they want to do, right? So you can't really move forward, right? So that's also linked, I think, our situation. And we always find a way to, survive in this, situation, because this is the, I think, we have a very serious this time, because not only because of the political instability, we face with the, serious, disaster, and pandemic, recently, right? I'm sure that we have, some, like others say, we have, we are resilient. Mm-hmm. By the way, I got really sick with that, resilient, because that's not our choice. But situation force us to be resilient, right? But on the other hand, we need to look at the country situation related to health, related to education, and related to, economic situation, which also directly linked with the country future development. We are innovative, but that innovation come with some cost. And that's why we need to look at, for future, not for the one government or one, regime that, make it difficult, right? So for me, I want to look at the future that we are having. And if I become a policymaker or leader who need to solve that one, right? So I need to have a clear plan and mind for that one.
Yeah. You mentioned how you're not a fan of the word resilient to describe the ways that Burmese have had to be innovative and to keep being able to survive and to persist in the most difficult of situations. And this has been a word, and I would say that not just this word, but I think anyone coming into the Myanmar space there, we can actually do a whole podcast on, 10 to 15 words from, civil war to shadow government to military regime to, all kinds of terminology that have become flashpoints of what do we use and how are we understanding it? What is actually happening? How are we portraying this to the international community? How are these words shaping the way that outside actors are understanding? So words and terminology are really interesting. And I know we're going on a little bit of a tangent here, but I think this is interesting to explore, because I do want to ask you about this word resilient. You mentioned that you don't like this word because Myanmar people don't have a choice. They're just doing what they can in these most difficult of situations. And so if resilient is a word that you're not a fan of and you would like to not be used, what alternative words would be more appropriate for describing what's going on and what the Myanmar people are doing?
The reason why I start, you know, at first, I thought, you know, we are resilient, right? But right after another, we recently faced with the earthquake. Before that, we have Typhoon Yagi. Before that, Cyclone Mocha and, you know, other disaster. So every time when we face with the disaster and I have that, you know, oh, Myanmar people are resilient and they can overcome and things like that. But again, that resilient, I think in reality, it's all, it also drag some of our, you know, drag down our motivation. And in some area, it's also the kind of like, you know, we have to compete for the resource that, you know, left in the community, right? It also, I think, affect to the social cohesion in some area. I will say these days, most of the area. So that's the kind of like, you know, another reason I guess I start, you know, getting tired with that, you know, resilient words. And I really want to suggest, you know, our neighbors and international community who are interested in Myanmar to support people who are suffering on the ground. The financial literacy, financial inclusion, and also financial knowledge, it take some time for people to understand and to get, you know, practice and to get used to it. What when we talk about the financial inclusion, digital, you know, safety, it's not for one regime. It's not for the, you know, one particular group. It's for everyone. And it's for, you know, longer term goal. So I have been working in that, in this area for some time. Before I came here for study, after 20, came out from Myanmar to Thailand, after 2021. And before I came here, I worked inside Myanmar. And I, like, as I mentioned, I have done research about, you know, migrant returnees, and the money received from the recipient household inside Myanmar. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of, you know, things that I did not really understand at that time. So after 2021, when I came in Myanmar, I got a chance to study in university, and I got, you know, some assistance from the international organization to conduct survey within migrant workers who came from Myanmar. Mm-hmm. So that's the great opportunity for me to start connecting all the dots and start answering the puzzle that I have when I was, you know, inside Myanmar. So at I also can, you know, connect with the different network, not only do the academic circle, but also do the you know, the organization that are assisting to the migrant workers here in Thailand. So this is the great opportunity for me to link with my what I study in school about economic theory and migration theory and inequality and gender aspect from the, you know, gender inequality issue. And that's how I can link up with my work experience inside Myanmar. So I am hoping that, you know, when I graduate, I have a chance to go back home and, you know, use my knowledge and skills that I gained in past years.
I hope you can as well.
I think we have when country opened up in 2011, mm-hmm. we talk a lot about the knowledge gap mm-hmm. and skill needs for Myanmar development. Mm-hmm. And we kind of like, you know, previous, you know, two governments also initiate a lot to fill that gap. And after 2021, I think we face that, you know, issue again. And so I really want international community and also other stakeholders to keep supporting Myanmar education inside or outside, especially inside Myanmar, so that we can, whatever situation come, we can solve the situation together with open-minded.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to this episode in full. If you found our guest story of value, please consider taking a further step beyond just being a listener and become an active supporter. Your contributions directly help us to continue to amplify voices from and about Myanmar, create more impactful content, and keep the conversation alive at a time when global attention is fading. Every donation, whether big or small, goes into producing more episodes like this one, sharing untold stories and ensuring they reach those who care. To learn more about how you can support us, visit insightmyanmar.org/donation. Yarananda, 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 Yarananda,